back together again, Thursday style, chatting it up with you, June 26, 2025, right here on Connecticut Today. I wondered if a startling primary win in New York City earlier in the week should worry the Democratic Party establishment here in Connecticut and maybe Governor Ned Lamont. State Republican Party Chair Ben Proto talked about the latest political news and a pair of controversial vetoes from Governor Ned Lamont. Republican State Senate member Dr. Jeff Gordon detailed the latest controversy surrounding the state's Public Utilities Regulatory Authority, PURA, while CBS News military analyst, retired U.S. Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, detailed the ongoing intelligence reviews of last weekend's U.S. military strikes in Iran.
So I brought this up yesterday as we were dissecting the win by Zohran Mamdani, not too far away here, down the road in the New York City Democratic mayoral primary. And I was kind of wondering out loud, and we were talking about this yesterday, right? And I've been saying this for weeks and months, but I'll just recap it again to set us up here. You know, we had the great Republican realignment, you know, you could say 2014, 2015, 2016, when Mr. Trump came down that golden escalator and said, I'm running for president. And me and a few million other people thought it was a joke. And look what happened. And I kept saying, well, if it happened to one party, it's going to happen to the other party. Now, with the Republicans, it wasn't necessarily an age thing. It was a policy thing more than an age thing. But did we see it now shift to be an age thing and a policy thing this past Tuesday night in New York? And the reason I bring this up again is I mentioned this yesterday, and lo and behold, the people at Hearst Connecticut Media, probably led by our good buddy Dan Haar, they must have been listening. No, I'm kidding. It's a joke. But you open up the physical paper, click on Hearst today, and you see this. You see this story. Quote, could Governor Ned Lamont face a primary challenge? And the quote there in the headline, he will not run uncontested. Hey, you Connecticut Democrats and Governor Lamont, should you be scared of this? Remember, nobody thought this guy Zohran Mamdani had any shot. Oh, my God, a young Muslim guy in New York City or in New York State Assembly, not really a known guy, and he pulled it off. Could that happen here in Connecticut? Because when you look at how Mr. Mamdani pulled it off, don't we have the same ingredients here in the state, right? He pulled it off. Number one, he had an incredible social media operation. Is Governor Ned Lamont going to be a social media guy if, perchance, he might be challenged from the left? You know, the name that's been out there for a couple of years now, Josh Elliott, state rep, youngish guy from Hamden. Defeated Brendan Sharkey, I think, a few terms ago. Well, okay then. I'm sure he could muster, if because of his age alone, can he muster, can Governor Lamont muster the kind of social media campaign and social media stuff that younger voters are going to try and look for here? I don't know. Look how Mamdani won the other night, too. Younger voters. How many younger voters in Connecticut are enamored with Governor Ned Lamont? Maybe they are. I'm not saying they're not, but Mamdani did very well with 18 to 34-year-old voters. Are 18 to 34-year-olds really into Ned Lamont again? Maybe he's a cool guy. You see him dancing around sometimes wearing his tie-dye T-shirt. Ned said once or twice he partook or partakes or whatever as a kid, whatever. It kind of humanizes him. But it seems like the governor and his ilk in the Democratic Party, are they poised for another takedown as we saw in New York? You know, they're breaking down more of the Mamdani numbers here. Andrew Cuomo won the black vote. I'm sure Ned Lamont would win the black vote. Would Ned Lamont win the black vote and then lose the young white vote, the young Asian vote, the young Latino vote? Maybe. Could be. And I know I've had a lot of pundits on the program, people like Dan Haar, who said, well, you know, if it comes from the left, it may only come from a one-dimensional candidate on the left, maybe somebody who's into the environment, maybe somebody who's into housing. Why can't there be a state legislator or a well-funded, deep-pocketed progressive who would say, hey, I'm into everything that the modern-day Democratic Party is not caring about? Are the Dems in Connecticut fat and happy and complacent? We may find out here. And after you saw what happened in New York, is Ned Lamont really safe? If, again, we're all assuming he runs again here, and a lot of people think he will. So do you think, here's what we'll open up with today, because I think it's a fascinating discussion. And if you're a Democrat, are you worried about this? Because I don't think you want somebody who is advocating for rent control, although it may work here in the state, and free bus rides, although we had it for here in the state. Is this the kind of banner, person carrying a banner, that you want for Democrats in Connecticut? Could a Democratic Socialist candidate like Zohran Mamdani defeat Governor Ned Lamont in a primary if the governor decides to run? You know, a couple of weeks ago, I was sitting here with my guest going, and no shot, maybe he'd get a few votes. I'm not so sure now. Honestly, I'm not doing this for effect. But I was talking about it enough days on this show, and then I click on the Connecticut Post today when I got into work and settled in. And, you know, you see this story, spells it right out, Alex Punderman's story. Could Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont face a primary challenge? He will not run uncontested. There's a headline quote from somebody mentioned in the story. And what if that person ran in Connecticut and won? Could a Democratic Socialist win in Connecticut? Well, of course not, Paul. Really? Now, I get it. The Cuomo name was a bit tired and a bit tarnished. I understand that. In New York City, and a whole bunch of people didn't vote. But what if the establishment, not just Governor Ned Lamont, but people like Lieutenant Governor Susan Bicewicz, William Tong, Stephanie Thomas, Sean Scanlon, all the other constitutional officers, would they be in any way, shape, or form threatened or vulnerable here? Because I think it's pretty clear now. Look, the Republicans had their MAGA moment, 2015, 2016, 2017. Is the tide starting to turn, finally, for the Democratic Party, which everybody said would happen, and it won't be limited to Washington? What happens when that tide turns here in Connecticut? And does the state lean even further left than it does right now? So what happens if a progressive House or Senate member in Connecticut wants to challenge Governor Ned Lamont, assuming he runs again? You think they get kneecapped? Or do they have a shot to pull off what Zohran Mamdani did the other night in New York? Now, again, there's a general election coming up. I still don't think he wins, but we have months to talk about that. But again, he appealed to younger voters who were strapped because everything in New York City is so damn expensive. Believe me, I know. My son lives there. The prices are nuts. Lunch for two in New York is $40, $50. That's crazy. Now, I know you can make a nice sandwich at home, but that's the way young people want to live. What would stop that from happening here in Connecticut? What if a young, good-looking, progressive, with a really slick social media platform and campaign and advisors got together and said, hey, stuff in Connecticut is too expensive, and I'm going to give you free bus rides, and I'm going to give you free this and free that. Will the governor be in trouble? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Because remember, Mamdani won it primarily by attracting white, Latino, Asian voters, young voters. 18 to 34 is what they're saying. Does Ned Lamont, with all due respect to the governor, I'm sure he's a nice guy, does he appeal to those voters? Is the state Democratic Party now all of a sudden in uh-oh mode? I'd be. They better get the kneecap squads out. Francis in Stratford starts us off today. Francis, how are you?
I'm fine. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
This is getting my ire up.
Oh, boy.
He's probably one of these sleeper cells. Good looking. Come on in. You know, I'm a real nice piece of candy.
Yeah?
They better wake up.
Okay.
They better wake up.
You think Mom Donnie's in a sleeper cell?
Who the hell knows the way this damn country's going?
Yeah.
All I know is I'm all American.
Okay.
I want to own property.
Good for you.
I want to own my own business.
Good for you.
And I'll fight for what's right.
I think, Francis, thank you for the call to start us off. I think we'll be okay. I do not think that Mr. Mom Donnie is in a sleeper cell. I don't. I honestly don't. I thought about that for about 20 seconds one day, and I said, no, I don't think a guy who was duly elected to the New York State Assembly is in a sleeper cell. Now, he could be in a political sleeper cell, meaning that he could be a big threat to the Democrats in New York. But what about here in Connecticut? Could a Zohran Mamdani be elected here in Connecticut? Why not? Or win a primary against Governor Ned Lamont? And now, apparently, one of the names we talk about all the time when I have my guests here, whether they're pundits, people like, you know, Gary Rose or Chris Powell or Chris Caruso, whatever, we always talk about the name that always pops up, and you can research this gentleman, and I'm efforting to get him on the show maybe tomorrow or early next week. Josh Elliott, state rep from Hamden. Young guy, good-looking guy, appeals to a young voter base. I believe he beat Brendan Sharkey a couple of cycles ago. Brendan was an incredibly powerful guy in Hartford. So how about it? Could that happen here? Could it happen here? It might. Because, again, if you get a young, well-spoken, good-looking progressive, male or female, with a good resume, and, again, the key thing here, and you're reading about this all over the place now, social media platforms. Social media platforms. If there's a challenger to the left of the governor, is Ned Lamont supposedly going to crank up his social media platform? You tell me. I don't know. Ned Lamont on TikTok, does it work? Well, he was just elected to another term as party chairman of the state Republican Party. And these chairmen, these chairwomen, these chairpersons, not an easy job, but he wants to do it again. Ben Proto is here to chat about that, what happened in New York, what's happening in Connecticut. Ben, first of all, congratulations. I know how tough your job is, though, but congratulations on another term, my friend.
Well, so, as some have said, congratulations and condolences. We've been working over the last couple of years to really put in place a solid infrastructure and organization to take us into the 2026 statewide elections. And I really wanted to see it through to then. And I was tremendously honored to have been unanimously reelected by the 74 members of the State Central Committee, including we have 18 new members of the committee who I had never worked with before, some of whom I've known before, some of whom I met for the first time when they came to the first meeting in May. So I was very honored that our entire executive team, our chair, our vice chair, Marianne Turner, our treasurer, Lou Spadaccini, and our secretary, Lisa Malone, were all unanimously reelected and unopposed in our office, seeking the office.
Yeah. So, Ben, give me your thoughts here on where we stand. First of all, the two vetoes that Governor Ned Lamont handed down the other day, the one on the housing bill, the one on the bill that would have, after 2 weeks, paid unemployment to striking workers. I thought those vetoes were fine and proper and the right thing to do. It's caused a little consternation on the other side. You think the governor may be susceptible, Ben, in 2026, either within his party or without? Give me your take on the general photo we have here.
I think the governor was right to veto both of those bills. I think there were a couple of others he might have looked at vetoing as well.
Mm-hmm.
But those two in particular, 5002, the housing and homeless bill, was, just a complete disaster of legislation. It was forcing every town in the state to undertake, somewhat large, in many cases, large developments. And what's interesting, Paul, is a lot of people, we're in Fairfield County,
mm-hmm.
we're a pretty industrialized area of the state, we'll call it. You go out to Litchfield County, you go out to Windham County, Collin County, places along those lines where they have no sewer systems.
Mm.
Everything is on septic. How do you build 24, 45 units without a sewer system, without a city water system? But all these towns would have been required under these rules and laws to do that. The concept that towns could not control their own town greens and public spaces for, basically tent cities was just ridiculous. And I think the governor was absolutely right to veto it. We called on him to veto it, as did, so many other groups, 169 Strong, the CCM, Connecticut Republicans, mayors and first selectmen of both parties, planning and zoning commissions of both parties called on him to veto this bill. So it had bipartisan veto support. And I think it was the right thing to do. Same thing with the Stryker bill.
Yeah.
That was just ridiculous. I know there's a couple of states out there that do that, very progressive states that do that. People choose to go on strike. That's their right to do that. I don't, begrudge them that right to do that. But when you do that, Paul, as we teach our children, as they're growing up, every decision we make in life has a consequence to
mm-hmm.
it. Sometimes it's a good consequence or a bad consequence or an kind of consequence. Well, when you make the decision to go out on strike, there's certain consequences that go with that, one of which is you're giving up your pay to do this. Who was going to be, because everybody forgets the Connecticut unemployment system was bankrupt a few years ago during COVID, and the federal government had to loan us over $1 billion to bail it out. Companies pay into that, and they're rated on the amount of money that's paid out on unemployment benefits. So that would increase the cost to companies on their unemployment insurance that they have to pay on their rating. So it was really a bad idea, and I think the governor did the right thing in vetoing it. Whether or not he's going to get challenged from inside his own party, I know there's a story today.
Yeah.
Josh Elliott, who is a far left progressive, makes the guy in New York look almost normal.
Wow.
has said, he might challenge the governor. You had Senator Anwar up in from South Windsor.
Yeah.
A doctor, a pulmonologist, I will give Senator Anwar his due. He's a very, very smart, intelligent man. Had wrote an op-ed basically telling Ned to move to Tennessee. you had Martin Looney recently say that wouldn't endorse and give him an endorsement. So there's some consternation within the Democratic Party right now, and it's going to kind of be fun to watch.
Yeah, and in fact, let me set this up. My last question for you here, Ben, and Ben Proto is the guest, GOP State Party Chairman. Here's a comment for you, Ben. Quote, now this rather prominent person, I don't know whether you saw this, you may have, they were asked about Mr. Mamdani's win Tuesday night in New York. The quote is, quote, I describe it as Christmas in July for the GOP. You know who said that, Ben?
Who said that?
John Fetterman.
Ned?
John Fetterman?
Yeah.
John Fetterman. He's becoming persona non grata here within his own party, I think.
We have a senator and a half Republican, one and a half Republican senators in Pennsylvania right now, and we're moving to two with him. I think the people of New York have lost their collective minds. With this, I'm not saying that Andrew Cuomo was the best pick, given his history, which I think speaks volumes about where things are in that city and in that state within the Democratic Party. You got Governor Hochul, who is under attack from her own side as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty crazy. And, it's you know, I know Curtis Sulawa is, you know, running again as a Republican. He's kind of the perennial Republican candidate. And I've always said, you know, Curtis has done great things in that city.
I was in law school
when he started the Guardian Angel in New York City. I was living
there. Ben, don't date yourself, Ben.
And, you know, he and his organization have done great things in that city, and he's to be commended, and he regularly is. But I think if the Republicans found a very strong candidate, I know there's a couple of very wealthy people in the city of New York who have basically stepped up and said, if you can find us a credible candidate who's articulate, who can do this, we will fund this thing because this man cannot be mayor of the city of New York.
Yeah.
Think about this for a minute, Paul. This is what I find amazing. New York City, clearly the number, in my opinion, the number one, but clearly in the top two cities for the, in the financial universe in this world,
is on
the precipice of electing a socialist who is going to basically strip the financial industry and our financial markets of everything, and basically destroy that city. I don't know what happened. You know, look, Andrew Cuomo, in my opinion, made the cardinal sin of politicians, and it's not what he did. That was bad enough. The cardinal sin is when you don't apologize for it. And he never said, I'm sorry. And the American people are forgiving people, but they have to be asked to be to forgive. They don't just give it, and he never did. And I think that was a huge problem for him, and I think that weighed heavily on a lot of people's minds.
Yeah, and finally, Ben, knowing you're a campaign veteran, you know, when you and I met on a couple of campaigns years ago, I guess now the mayor of New York, Eric Adams, who I think has done a decent job, he just came out firing, guns blazing today, Ben. And the slogan he's using is that this is a choice between him and Mr. Mamdani, blue collar versus silver spoon. What do you think, Mr. Proto, as a consultant?
Well, it's, you know, it's you're trying to now take a socialist and turn him into a rich guy. And I don't really know his background that well, but it's an interesting strategy. But the thing I find more interesting in New York City, as you know, Paul, there is a very, very, very large Jewish population in New York City. And I know Mr. Mamdani is trying to figure out how to connect his Muslim socialist beliefs into the Jewish community and, you know, bridge that gap. And I think that's going to be a very difficult thing for him to do. And I think the Jewish community is going to play a significant role in the mayoral election this year.
All right, Ben Proto. Ben, good luck. Another term of state GOP chair, and Ben will chat down the road. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
All right, Ben, thanks. Ben Proto there, longtime associate and friend of mine. Good guy. Man, we could talk politics for hours with him. All right, let's wrap it up here with another controversy surrounding PURA, the Public Utility Regulatory Authority. And to update us on that, because the PURA odyssey never ends. State Senate member, Republican Dr. Jeff Gordon. Jeff, good afternoon, sir. How are you on a Thursday?
I am doing well. How are you?
Not too bad, Jeff. All right, so let's explain to my listeners what's going on here. PURA, Marissa Gillette, and now we're reading, Jeff, and I said this earlier, three words you never want to see together, deleted text messages. What exactly is going on here? What do we have to deal with here?
Well, this is just a sad story. The controversy at PURA never ends, just like everybody's sky-high electric bills never seems to end, unfortunately. But, you know, this is something that's coming out in court where some of the utilities have sued PURA. And now we're finding out under legal questioning by a judge that, oh, some very critical key text messages by a public official to the chairs of the Energy and Technology Committee, who are also public officials, somehow these got deleted. Real key ones. It reminds me of what went on with Watergate about the missing minutes of the tape.
The gap on the Nixon tapes, Jeff, that's something you and I can remember.
It is, and that's why right now I'm asking, what did Marissa Gillette know, and when did she know it?
When did she know it? Very good.
But this is just unfortunate because it gets to some really key points about, you know, the average person in Connecticut, hardworking, struggling to pay high electric bills, in part because of decisions by Marissa Gillette and PURA, want to know, was there possible collusion with legislators in writing certain op-eds to make her look good in a public relations way, and suddenly those key text messages just seem to be gone.
Yeah.
That's just way too convenient.
Yeah, and Jeff, the other thing is here, not only that, but we have this, the op-ed thing, but again, we also have this lingering question here from some good reporting around the state saying, hey, was she acting as, you know, king, queen, and bishop here when she was signing off on stuff, or somebody was signing off for her? And was there any real deliberation here on some of these things, or was she making unilateral decisions? Also, Jeff, at a time where, I don't know, maybe you can explain this. I don't understand why there's only three people on the Pura board when, what, there's supposed to be five? Why is this being allowed?
It shouldn't be allowed. The law is very clear. Law says that the governor shall nominate five commissioners.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't say may, it says shall. But this has gone on for a very, very long time with just having three. And then suddenly, because that seemed to be an inconvenient truth when my Republican colleagues and I raised it, there was a bill, an effort in the Energy Committee to say, well, maybe we'll just change the law and keep it at three. We don't have to worry about five. That didn't go anywhere. But it does speak to why you didn't have the full complement of commissioners. And as you said, why does it look to be that she was the queen maker here, just making evidently decisions by herself as chair? One person affecting everybody in the state with sky-high electric bills? That's a bad way of government to function. And when you shed light on it, this is the types of things that you start to find out.
And Jeff, it saddens me, too, because I remember reading this a few months ago. Oh, they're going to have five people on there, supposedly. Wasn't this deal put in place or suggested where John Fonfara on the Democratic side and Holly Cheeseman on the Republican side, we got it all figured out now. There's going to be five people, and they're going to be put on the Pura. It's going to function better. Well, what happened with that?
Yeah, it was a last minute, in a sense, backroom deal that really smacked of politics galore. People don't like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the deal fell apart for various other reasons, including finding out more information about what was going on with one of the possible nominees, mm-hmm. with a business. I guess having some like $1 million in fines with Pura, which, you know, so that's not good.
No.
If you want to be a Pura commissioner. So the deal fell apart. And then people, you know, asked me, so Senator, why did you vote against Gillette's reappointment?
Yeah.
Why did you vote against Commissioner Arconti's reappointment? And my answer to them is, why wouldn't I vote no? Because of all these deals, bad decisions, we need a clean sweep and a big revamp of Pura to fight for people, which is what my Republican colleagues and I have been doing.
Yeah, and Jeff, it's sad because people like me and people on the other side of the aisle, too, ratepayer, you know, Jeff, I think you were somebody told me over the months here, you know, electric bills don't have a D or an R attached to them. Like, everybody's got to pay their electric bill, whether it's UI, Avangrid, or Eversource, say for about 10 towns in the state, one of which I live in, by the way. But having said that, it's just sad that this can never really get straightened out, isn't it? I mean, as a legislator, it must drive you nuts.
Oh, it does. And then when you try to explain this to my constituents, their eyes glaze over like, oh, you know, another controversy going on in Hartford. And I agree with them. And this is why my Republican colleagues and I, including a strong press release we issued today, want in a bipartisan way the Government Oversight Committee to do its job, which is oversight of the government. Mm-hmm. Let's look into this, find out what is really going on, and then in a transparent way, so the public knows, present the facts, and then see what more we can do to fix this agency and get state government working for people, which it really should be. And we'll see where that goes, but I hope the legislative leaders of the House and Senate listen to their constituents like I do and really get the Government Oversight Committee to look into this, because what other reason do we have a government oversight committee?
Exactly. It's not not complicated. Dr. Jeff Gordon, Republican State Senate member. Jeff, good to speak with you. Fight the fight, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Dr. Jeff Gordon, there you go. And as you and I have been hearing top and bottom of the hour all day today, more debate upon exactly how much damage was done to the Iranian nuclear threat from the U.S. attacks of last Saturday, coming up a week ago. Joining us right now to chat about that from his perspective, retired U.S. Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS News military analyst. Colonel, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. And what are your thoughts here, Colonel, regarding what you've seen, what you may have talked about with your sources and the folks in your area? Give us your wide view on this.
Well, the first thing is one cannot but admire the professionalism of the U.S. military in executing this extraordinary complex mission that involved all services, a number of our commands, European Command, NORTHCOM, CENTCOM, Space Force. How would you like a 38-hour ride in an airplane? Okay. Round trip, six refueling en route, encounter some fighters to escort you in, and doing that flawlessly to hit the targets right on the spot and exit without any loss of life, injury, or any defense by the Iranians. So an extraordinary mission, to be sure. Now we're involved in a bit of a controversy, of course, about how much of that effect occurred. But clearly, I think, as the CIA director summarized it, you know, severe damage was done to the Iranian nuclear infrastructure. But we have to be concerned now, I think, about a couple other things, and that is nuclear programs consist of infrastructure, technology, and knowledge. There's still the accounting of 800 pounds of highly enriched uranium that we know the Iranians had, that they could, in fact, if they still have some residual centrifuges somewhere, they could enrich that to weapons-grade uranium and potentially create a crude weapon if they wanted to. And then lastly, of course, knowledge still remains. The Iranians have had nuclear programs since 1957. So even though the Israelis have killed about 10 scientists, they still have a lot of knowledge left. So now the question is, and then what? What happens now in terms of the aftermath? What does Iran decide to do? Do they decide to compromise, or do they decide to accelerate for a weapon? And can we negotiate some kind of a long-term settlement that accounts for that active material and perhaps also urges the Iranians to accept restrictions on longer-range missiles and support for various terrorist organizations throughout the region?
Colonel, you mentioned about the intricacies of the mission and all the various U.S. commands around the world. In your opinion, how long did that mission take to plan, or was it one of these things that's kind of always been in the folder somewhere, and it was used last week? Long term, short term. How much planning goes into that?
Oh, this is a long term plan. The United States military has war plans for a number of contingencies, and the design of this weapon began back in the administration of George W. Bush,
the bunker
probably
buster.
Nearly 20 years ago, focused on a weapon like this, perhaps to be used also in Korea against similar nuclear facilities that the North Koreans were developing. And then it was refined as a mission during the Obama administration. Weapon was tested again under the Biden administration as our relations with Iran deteriorated at times, and now refined a bit more, I'm sure, for this actual mission that occurred only a few days ago.
And finally, Colonel, you know, I was looking at the specs on this, and, you know, it's not all that big, this bunker buster. It's about 3.5 feet wide by what I saw, about 20 or 21 feet long, but it weighs 28,000 pounds. What a beast to handle, to load into the B-2, and then to get it over the target, and it flies itself. It really is a technological marvel, isn't it?
Yeah, to say the least, the B-2 bomber is the only aircraft that can deliver this weapon. Each B-2 would carry about two.
Wow.
And it appears that 12 of those were dropped on Fordo, to give you some idea of what that must have been, like, with great precision. And they are so heavy because, of course, it's a case-hardened steel outside of the container. So, in fact, it can penetrate all the way through and then explode underground. The Fordo facility being 250 feet deep. So let's imagine where the actual centrifuges were about as below ground, about the height of the Statue of Liberty.
Wow. Colonel, thank you. Retired U.S. Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS News military analyst. Thank you, sir, and we'll chat down the road. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right, there you go.